The following is a presentation of Geekster Media.
Spider friends, and welcome to an amazing, spectacular, and sensational episode of Wizards, the podcast guide to comics. You've entered our web of nostalgia, and that's not my spider sense tingling, if you know what I mean. Wait, do I know what I mean? Well, I'm Adam.
I don't know what you mean, Adam. I'm just over here waiting for Canadian Spider-Man to show up in the movies.
And joining us tonight, though, is a man who you might say is the Norman Osborn to Mike's Harry Osborn. You know, without all the homicidal insanity and pumpkin bombs. A man who was buying all the original issues of The Amazing Spider-Man off the racks in the 60s and beyond. It's Mike's dad, Joe Schwartz. Welcome, Joe.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Adam. I'll take that as a compliment. You're too kind. Thank you.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And I have another podcast called Rental Return Tales from the Video Store. We interview people about their video rental store experiences as employees, as managers, or whatever. And we had a great conversation with Joe and Mike because they both spent time, you know, in rental stores. And during that conversation, I was just like, what a pair. And Joe has so many stories, and knowing that really the main passion is comic books. I was just like, Mike, we got to have him on. Let's get into it. But Mike, our listeners probably know you talk about your dad all the time on the podcast. So is it safe to say that you wouldn't be hosting this show if not for Joe?
Oh, yeah. There's no way. There's a lot of...
Such a bad influence.
Maybe we can say that since I am jobless right now. Yes, a horrible influence. You should have said, be a doctor, you know, go to medical school.
I know. I'm just a failure as a father. Right?
But there's a lot of things that have inspired me throughout the years, you know, like there's certain writers that inspired me and certain filmmakers and stuff. But the truth is it all is because of my dad. Like, I would not be a writer. I wouldn't have this comic book collection. The reason I'm on this podcast, Adam, is because of my dad, for sure. And you know, everything he introduced me to as a kid and continues to introduce me to as an adult. So yeah,
I always wished that, you know, it would be a great hobby for you, and as it was for me, but I didn't realize the passion would run so deep
into a career that goes on. Yes, and off.
And I'm really looking forward to Armored. Gotta plug that. I can't wait for it.
Well, here's the thing, guys. We are going to talk Spider-Man. We're going to talk about this special issue of Wizard Magazine. But first, we have to know if Joe was bitten by a radioactive comic book fan in order to become the super collector that he is. So, Joe, please tell us your origin story.
Well, you know, it was actually a buddy of mine when I was in grade 6 had introduced me to, I think it was the Green Goblin issues, number 39 and 40, The Amazing Spider-Man. You see, I was used to reading, I think my first comic book that I ever purchased was when I was about 6 years old on my own. It was like Submarine Attacks or something like that. And then I read like Solar, Dr. Solar, I read Magnus, you know, just here and there, you know, just picking up comic books, you know, because I was pretty young. I mean, I would be able to go into, there's this restaurant around the corner from where my grandparents live. And my grandma and grandpa were so good to me. I stayed with them pretty much every weekend because my mom and dad were real party animals. So they loved going out, drop Joey off to the grandparents. I'd stay with them. And naturally, I needed things to do. So they lived right close to downtown Waterloo. And I'd go to this restaurant and they carried some comic books in a showcase. They'd give me 25 cents, right? A quarter. And I'd be able to buy an ice cream cone and a comic book.
What a deal.
Yeah. Or maybe two comic books, because in those days, comic books were only 12 cents each, right? And I could get an ice cream cone for 6 cents.
Oh, God.
I mean, that was even cheap back then. But then a friend of mine came up to me and he said, you know, like he knew that I loved The Flash. I loved Green Lantern. You know, I read them voraciously, but, you know, they were silly. And, you know, I think it was the colors of the costumes that really attracted me at that young age, you know, 7, 8. 9 years old, and you know, on the fact that they had these superpowers and that. But when he gave me this comic book and I said, oh, it looks really dark, you know, I don't know, it's too serious for me. He said, no, read it. You'll love it. You'll love it. I said, okay. So I took it home and I read it and I was just blown away. It was just, oh my God, it's so realistic. I couldn't believe it. Spider-Man has a girlfriend and he has a friend whose father is mentally deranged, and oh my God, it just blew me away. That hooked me right away. And from then on, I was a voracious collector and reader of Marvel comics.
So at that time, obviously, you know, they're going to be on the racks, like you're saying, you can buy a comic at a newsstand or whatever. But when you say you're becoming a collector, is that only new issues, or did you find a way in those early days to trade and get older issues? How did that work?
No, there was no way. There were no comic book stores in those days. I had a favorite store I would go to on my way to piano lessons, and I would get an allowance. You know, I'd get like a dollar allowance or something like that. I can't remember. And I would buy as many issues as I could. And so for 12 cents, I'd be able to get maybe, what, 8 issues, right? And after a while, I mean, there were more that I wanted to collect. I didn't want to collect just 8 titles. I wanted more. So every once in a while, I'd skip going to piano lessons and take the money that my mom gave me for piano lessons and buy comic books. I'd come home with these comics and hide them. And my mom would say, how was piano lessons? Oh, it was great. That's what I learned today.
Ever get any pushback from your parents in your collecting and in your voraciousness?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah. Well, my mother was sort of open to it because she collected comics, romance comics, back in the 50s. And apparently she had a stack of them like this. And when my mother and father got married, my father got upset at my mother because she was reading and buying these comics all the time, spending her time with the comics and not with him. So she had to get rid of them.
Man, I didn't realize how deep comic books were in our DNA. It goes generations, no Adam.
No kidding. I just wish she would have kept those. I'm sure, you know, from the late 1940s, early 1950s, romance comics, you know, be worth a little bit today, right? You know, and kind of interesting, a little bit of interesting history and a take on the misogyny back then, and, you know? Yeah, but my father, he was not open to me reading comic books very much. So I just kind of kept them aside and read them when I could. But your question was how did I read some of the back issues? So I had a friend who lived across the street. He was 2 years older than me. So he collected comics before I did. And his passion was Spider-Man as well. So he had all the old issues from issue number 10. So he would give me, and he had a stack like this. So I didn't really read anything previous to number 39 or 38 of Amazing Spider-Man. And he had some other comics as well, too, but it was mostly all Spider-Man. So I got to read his. He had pretty much every issue from number 10 to issue number 38. So I was able to catch up and read the history of it later on. And my wish was, oh my God, how can I ever go? And I had heard about these comic conventions going on in California. And it was just the beginnings of comic book conventions back then. And I always wished, God, if I ever get older, I'm going to try to buy, you know, all the comic books that I possibly can. You know, all the ones that I love today, so I can have all the collections. And now today I have pretty much all the collections in my old age.
So during this period that, like you're saying, you're evolving as a fan, you know, 60s, we're getting into the 70s, moving forward into the 80s, you're married, you're running a video store eventually during this time. Like, how did your collection and how did your habits evolve? Like, did you have a down period, or were you always at the comic book store or at least the newsstand during those decades? Like, how did you continue to feed the need?
No, you know, I did have a down period. I think around 1971, 72, I sort of dropped out. I lost interest. I was more interested in girls.
That old story. Things.
Yeah. When Michael came along, we ended up becoming very cloistered in our house, right? You know, we didn't have the freedom like we did before. I mean, that's what happens when you have kids, right? So I got back into comic books again. It was a good way to get off into my own world for a little while here and there. And especially when he was an infant. And then my passion started growing and growing again. And I would drag little baby Michael all over to comic book stores. The first comic book store I remember in our area was Nellinen Comics, and it was run by a fellow named Harry Kramer. And he ran it out of his mother's house. He lived with his mother. And he turned the living room into like a comic book store. And that's my first recollection of an actual comic book store at that time. And that was way back in 1974, 1975. Wow. That he opened it. But I didn't really go there until Michael was born in the 1980s.
During the spring, the comic book stores are starting to really, you know, bloom and exist in the 80s. What was pulling you back in? Like, were you going like, oh, I'm just going to see what's going on with Spider-Man? Or were there books you were now hearing about in the store? You're like, oh, did you hear about this Frank Miller Daredevil or this and that? Like,
oh, for me, obviously, it was Spider-Man and Avengers. I mean, it just brought back memories from my youth, right? It was a lot of nostalgia. That's what it was for me. Now that I had access to older comics, I really wanted to buy the comics of my youth. So I was able to purchase them, you know, a little bit at a time. I loved Tales of Suspense because I collected that back in the 60s. So then, you know, I just continued collecting them in the 80s as well, too. You know, I read Iron Man, you know, the Spider-Man comic books. I think Spectacular Spider-Man was released during the 80s as well. And the new X-Men, pretty much all the titles. You know, that I loved back in the 60s, I was purchasing again.
My dad's collection's interesting because it really is heavy on the Silver Age. And then I would say the Bronze Age, it's a bit like, mm-hmm. You could see his gap there.
The 70s, yeah, I don't have very much. Yeah.
That's where I'm filling that gap so that we have every comic. Between exactly. The two of us.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
The other question that I have is, so like you say, throughout the 80s, Mike is growing up. He's living in comic book stores, basically. He's being trained. And then, like, you know, 1990, 1991 hits. All of a sudden, we have a boom. Like, comics yeah. are big business. Everybody's reading them. Every kid is interested. Every adult seems to be interested in the monetary value of their comics. So what was your personal experience with the 90s comic book boom? And specifically Spider-Man, it felt like Todd McFarlane really kind of kicked that off in a big way.
Yeah, I loved Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man. Yeah, second to none. I mean, that brought my interest back into Spider-Man again, because I was kind of getting disillusioned with Marvel Comics by the time the, you know, the 90s rolled around. And it was a real comic book boom. And I personally got interested in the Valiant comics, the Gold Key reboots, like Dr. Solar, Turok, Exo, Man of War was, you know, loved Archer and Armstrong. And I love the stories. The art wasn't always the best, you know, wasn't the greatest, but the stories I loved. But everybody else that I talked to in those days, you wanted the artwork, wanted the fancy foil covers that were coming out and the variant covers and everything else. Everybody was going crazy with them. Me, I liked the stories more. I appreciated the art. I loved the stories. And that got me really interested. Probably the downside to it is I ended up spending so much money during the 90s because of all of these new titles coming out. And I was still collecting the Marvel titles as well, even though I was getting disillusioned.
But tell them about, we ended up finding a comic shop. We kind of went to three different comic shops. Like, yes. We had pull lists at three different ones, Adam. Yeah. Three.
Yeah.
But we found one in our town, because the other two were outside of our town, that gave us an insane discount. Do you remember what the discount was?
I know, and thank God we found it. They gave us 50% off.
What?
The comics, yeah. Yeah, he was a new store, and I think he wanted volume, right? So I think in those days, the more volume you got, the bigger discounts you got from the distributor. And yeah, that saved me from going bankrupt. No, I jest. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but it was bad enough. If I paid full price for them, I don't think I could have purchased all the titles I did.
Well, Mike is the 50 cent comic collector on Instagram. You could have been 50% off comic collector, you know, just show that collection, all the stuff you guys bought. So, Joe, as we wrap up here, you know, going through your comic book origin, what now? Because I know you guys are hitting up conventions all the time, always just having fun, digging, finding the deals. But what is your most prized comic book, whether it's sentimental value or actual collectible value?
Well, that's so easy. Amazing Fantasy 15.
I cannot believe this. We're seeing it.
And, you know, I looked it up last night to see what the value was. And I was just reading that a few years ago, I guess it was a near mint copy, sold for $6.5 million. And I'm looking at mine, I'm going, I wonder. Would this be my retirement fund, or do I keep it as a legacy for my kids?
Legacy.
But you said that you found this at a comic book store. Did you? Are you negotiating for it? How did this come to be in your possession?
Yeah, I thought you'd never ask that. Well, this comic book store that opened in this guy's house, he expanded into their dining room as well. I think him and his mom lived upstairs. They moved everything upstairs. And he used to have a string running across the top near the ceiling, right? And he'd hang comic books from it, you know, ones that he thought would sell really fast or would be real key comics that would be worth quite a bit of money. And I walked in, I said, oh my God, there's an Amazing Fantasy. Oh, I'm 15. Oh my God. But this is only like 1985, 1986. But still, it was, wow, I can't believe it. Amazing Fantasy, $50. God, I just had a kid. $50 was so much money. And he kept on saying, he says, well, he says, you know what? He says, sounds like a lot of money now, but, you know, later on, it's going to be worth a lot more and you're not going to be able to get it. I go, yeah, I know, but God, $50. I mean, when you're only making like about $150 a week, $50 is a lot of money. You're like, God, do I buy groceries this week? Does Michael really doesn't need his Pablum cereal? Anyway, I broke down, found the $50 and bought it. And I'm glad I did, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It is my pride and joy.
I just want to interject before we finish here. He also owns X-Men 1, Avengers 1. You don't have Spider-Man 1. That is his one. That's
no, I don't. Mail.
So, but he has
Spider-Man number. I have Amazing number 2.
Yeah, but he has it all. Like, he's covered. Yeah. Silver Surfer, everything. Yeah. He had, like, throughout my childhood, he'd give me, when he would upgrade a copy of something, he would give me, as we all know, my comics were stolen, so I had a bunch stolen, but he had kept duplicates of Amazing Spider-Man that he had been upgrading. And so he gave me a few years ago, basically a box of all of his duplicate Amazing Spider-Mans, which were like issue, what, like 33, 32, all the way up to like 100 random issues, and including annual number 1. He had two copies of this first annual.
Yeah. And you know what? I have a third copy of some as well. I was going through them last night.
Oh my God.
That is a journey in and of itself. We still got a whole issue to explore and examine. So we're going to get into our table of contents. Now, the Wizard Special Publication Spider-Man, aka the Wizard Spider-Man Special Edition, was a magazine published in 1998 in anticipation of the relaunch of the Marvel Comics Heroes line of books in an effort to, you know, satisfy old readers, bring in new ones who thought maybe there were too many stunt events that had muddled the continuity throughout the 90s. And the issue came packed with a comic book-sized booklet titled The Legacy of Spider-Man, which featured black and white sketches by artists of the era like Carlos Pacheco and Mike Wieringo and Umberto Ramos, Ron Lim, Dan Jurgens, Tony Daniels, so many more. They had the assignment to reinterpret famous moments from Spider-Man's history. So it wasn't just like, do a random sketch. It's like, take a moment and do your version. So I did scan this. We shared it with our patrons. We'll share some of these on social media. But for you guys, is there a favorite piece in this book that stands out to you? Joe, do you have one?
Oh, I do. Obviously, yes. Yeah. And you know what? I pulled out all the comics too, just to compare. And yeah, they're all very good. But I have to admit, I don't remember that Wizard issue, although I did read Wizard quite regularly back then. But I think my favorite one is undoubtedly The Death of Gwen Stacy. That one really brings out the feelings.
Who's the artist? Oh, Carlos Pacheco.
Yes, yeah. It's just so realistic. And even behind the mask, Spider-Man's mask, you can see the rage and, you know, the doom, you know, behind it.
Yeah, yeah, I can't wait to talk about that in a little more detail as we get into it. But Mike, what about you? What are you loving in this?
Do you know what I found most interesting is some of these artists I'm not like the biggest fans of, but I love their penciling. I think their ink, the inking sometimes actually ruins it. Like, I like Carlos Pacheco, but this piece is one of the best pieces I've seen by him, but it's not inked. It's penciled and it's beautiful. But my favorite in particular,
I think I know what it is, but you tell me if I'm wrong. Is it the Jim Ballant Man Wolf?
I do enjoy that one.
It's so horrible.
No, that one I really like the artwork. I mean, if it comes down to artwork, the feeling is Gwen Stacy, but the artwork and the Man Wolf one.
I kind of love the Doug Monke. Is it, how do you say his name?
I always is it Mank or Mankey? Yeah,
Mankey. Yeah, that's the one that sticks out to me. Or the Jim Calafiore, the Aquaman artist. Uh-huh. I like that one as well. That's just, it's all amazing, and I almost feel like inking would ruin all of these.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that they stuck.
No offense to inkers.
That was my choice too. Is the Doug Mankey the Spidey versus Hulk? I love Hulk, his yeah. Hulk. I don't know if he ever got a run on Hulk, not that I'm aware of, but the rendering of just the physique. My wife just was walking by when I was flipping through the book, and she's like, "Is that an anatomy book? What are you reading?" And I'm like,
"Yeah."
So detailed. I do want to mention they got Mark Bagley to do one with Spidey versus Juggernaut, which is awesome, but he was the Amazing Spider-Man artist for years, so that's cheating. I'm like, why are you going to put Mark Bagley in there? Like, of course, we know he could draw Spider-Man. Now, I want to mention the special also featured the Who's Your Spider-Man contest, in which readers were challenged to create a new costume design for the webhead. So we will find that in a future issue of Wizard, I'm sure. But on this topic, there is an article in the issue called Fashion Sense, which is an exploration of the various incarnations of the Spider-Man costume over the years. And, you know, Joe, I'm very much like you. I'm about the stories, but the visuals will grab you and pull you in, especially when they're changing something. So aside from the original blue and red, do you have a favorite alternate costume worn by Spider-Man over the years at some point?
I do. I should mention the visuals mean a lot to me. If I don't have the visuals, the story is great. But if I don't have the visuals with the story, I'm not interested. Forget it. The story means a lot to me. But anyway, getting to the costume, I like the Spider-Man 2099 costume.
Yeah!
Really? You too? I didn't think anybody would pick that.
I have a huge collection of Spider-Man 2099 stuff behind
the stand. Yeah. That is such a unique costume. I mean, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Menacing. That's what I loved about it. It was menacing. You know, originally Steve Ditko was looking for a sort of menacing look when he first did Spider-Man, drew Spider-Man back in the 60s. And it probably, that worked in the 60s because I already thought, oh my God, this is too scary for me. They did. They actually did. But 2099 sort of brought that back for me, that menacing feel to it. And I would have been happy if Spider-Man would have changed to that costume.
Oh, wow. That would have been interesting.
Yeah. It's like a step up from Spider-Man.
Yeah, it really is. Like, it is, it's intimidating in a big way. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
How about you, Mike? Right.
Okay, the simple answer is the black suit, but I'm not going to go with that. I've always loved that. I think it's because that's when I grew up, but I still remember getting the foil cover for Web of Spider-Man 100 in that armor. I remember, do you remember that one, Dad?
For one issue only, armor. Yeah.
I think that image alone just was ingrained in my head, and I've always loved it, and I want to see it again. I'm sure they've brought it back a few times here and there. I just don't know about it, but I love the look of it.
Yeah.
It's nostalgic.
The action figure. Yeah. That was
the action. I know they made it.
One issue, make it action figure. Hey, it's toyetic. That's what they say, right?
Yeah. And Adam, is yours 2099? Is that
In my heart, like, I was gonna go there, but I was like, for Peter Parker adjacent costumes, because like I would just go, yeah, but Miguel O'Hara's his own thing. Yeah. But I've always loved the Ben Reilly, you know, what I call like the sensational Spider-Man costume. Eventually it gets worn by Mayday Parker, you know, Spider-Girl. Like, I think it was a worthy replacement for the original design. It didn't feel as overly 90s as the Scarlet Spider. Like, from the design concept of it, it's pretty basic. And I think I always just felt like if this was going to be Spider-Man going forward, kind of like they were teasing us with, I was like, I would have been okay with that as a kid. And I was enjoying the storyline, but I'm seeing Joe's face.
I don't know. Well, hey, we all have our opinions, right? Yeah.
So in the 80s, when the black costume first appeared, because that was like they went all in. It was like in all the corner boxes, it was everything. This is Spider-Man now. He's wearing a black costume. What was your reaction at that time?
Oh, I was hoping that it would end.
Oh.
Truthfully, loved the character. Still love Amazing Spider-Man stories and that. In those days, Web Spider-Man came out as well. I think there were, what, three or four titles that came out of Spider-Man, and they all featured the black costume, of course. And I learned to live with it. That's it was so fine. It's just, you know, hey, you could easily say that's menacing as well. But I mean, black. I mean, come on. Black.
Too basic. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, Punisher had a black costume. You know, everybody had black. I mean, black seemed to be the thing. It was, ooh, Batman black.
Because Wizard was always about the newest thing, the special had several articles hyping the relaunch of the Spider-Man titles in late 98, which found Howard Mackey writing both The Amazing Spider-Man with art by John Byrne and Peter Parker Spider-Man with art by John Romita Jr. We have covered the plans for these books reported in the main Wizard magazine at length, so we don't need to get into that conversation on this episode. But also being hyped is Spider-Man Chapter 1, a slight revamping of Spider-Man's origin story for the modern era, a book being written and drawn by John Byrne. That's a lot of John Byrne Spider-Man coming at fans in 98-99, so we have to ask, Dad, what is your opinion of John Byrne's work in general, and did you think he was a good fit for Spider-Man?
Well, I love John Byrne's little stint on X-Men. I love Alpha Flight, of course. So
every Canadian brilliant. Has to say that.
And it was Canadian content, too. A little bit biased there. I was not a fan of Chapter 1 because I never bought it either. I vaguely remembered it when I was told about this. I had to really think back, and I remember just passing over it because I didn't think the stories needed to be rewritten and revamped. Yeah. I mean, why would you reboot something that's perfect already, in my opinion?
How about you, Mike? So, like, where do you fall on Byrne?
Well, I love Byrne. Like, I feel like his art, it started to, like, I have some of his Wonder Woman stuff, and I feel like it just starts to feel like he's rushing or something. I don't know. I don't love his later stuff. But as for the Spider-Man, I see it in the dollar bins or the 50-cent bins, and I pass it up all the time. I'm just like, I know the originals. Why do I need
it? With John Byrne, it all depends on his inker, right?
That's true. Yeah.
I always felt it was always the inker that interpreted his art. And I loved his work. I mean, it's no doubt about that. But I felt, you know, just like Jack Kirby's pencils weren't the greatest, but if he was inked by the proper people, it could really turn into a masterpiece.
It's interesting because, yeah, I think because, especially for those people who came up with John Byrne as like this hot new X-Men artist, they think of him as an artist first, but I always think of him as a writer. I love his creator-owned stuff. I like, you know, I love She-Hulk, especially Sensational She-Hulk, just so close to my heart. I love the comedy of all that, but like, I haven't explored a lot of his Fantastic Four. I've read scattered issues of his Superman stuff, but I think this Spider-Man work, because I have gone to revisit it to kind of catch up with this era, and it is just kind of weak. It's like, for art-wise and the Chapter One, it's just, I think it's the wrong angle to come in reimagining the origins. That's a pointless exercise, like you said. I really think it would have been better just give John Byrne like a 12-issue run to tell stories in the established continuity, but then explore certain questions he always had about the Spider-Man universe. That's what I felt like, even though they were rebooting with Man of Steel, it was more like, well, this is what I always thought Superman should be, and so I'm kind of giving my version why this would make more sense. Like in the Avengers West Coast, when he debunked the idea that Vision was created out of the original Human Torch's body, he's like, I never liked that, so I'm writing that out. I like the retconning within the existing ongoing narrative, rather than starting from scratch and just saying, this is the new origin, get on board, accept it. Like, I don't like that clean cut. It's like, no, let's weave it in. Like, oh, there's a revelation. That's kind of cool. Okay.
Yeah. Be a little bit more creative, in other words.
Surprisingly, in this issue, Wizard does not take the route of trying to rank Spidey's 10 best villains, but they do provide a list of all the major supporting characters, good and bad, in a piece they call Livelihood. But since best is a subjective term, we're just going to give each other a chance to name our favorite Spider-Man villain. So I'm just curious, in all your years of reading, Mike, it was literal bedtime stories for you. Who is the best Spider-Man villain, in your opinion?
Oh my God, that's really hard because I feel like I'm influenced by the comics that my dad read me as a kid, but I'm also very influenced by the animated series, right? Like, if I think about the comics, I think about Green Goblin. If I think about the cartoon, I always go back to the Venom saga. So and Carnage and that whole 90s era when Carnage came in and we had Maximum Carnage. So I'm it's to me it's like a tie between Green Goblin and Venom and a little bit Carnage.
Wow, interesting. Okay, Joe, what about you?
You're right, Adam. It is very subjective. I actually have three favorite villains, but I have one in particular that I really like. And if I could just take the time, the Lizard, okay, I felt was very tragic because he had a vision, you know, to regenerate limbs, you know, like do something for mankind. You know, he's a family man. He was a scientist. He had a kid. And in the end, you know, Spider-Man sort of saves him. And he knew him personally as well, too, as a professor, right? So I like that. Dr. Octopus, oh my God, some of the most memorable stories, like If This Be My Destiny. He befriends Peter Parker's Aunt May and becomes sort of a love interest. And we can't forget the marriage of Aunt May to Doc Ock.
What's your third? Because I feel like I know.
My favorite, and the reason why, is the Green Goblin. Because he is so complex. Think of it. You know, he brought mental illness into the picture. Drugs. You know, what issue was it with the drug issue? Number 96 to 98. You know, the drug issue. I mean, there were just so many memorable moments. And it seemed bizarre to me because a lot of mental illness wasn't discussed back in the 1960s. But it was sort of... To me, it was brought to the forefront for me in issue number 39 when Norman Osborn went crazy and became the Green Goblin. And, you know, it showed that his backstory more. Because when Steve Ditko did the Green Goblin, there really wasn't much backstory behind it. But we learned more when John Romita took over. John Romita Sr., that is. Yeah, so I just feel that as a complex character, the Green Goblin is undoubtedly my favorite.
Yeah, there's just
so many memorable moments.
I thought you were going to say Kingpin. I always remember you liking Kingpin when we read it. And I was like, this is a big fat guy. And you were like, he's made of muscle. And you and you made me appreciate him. I remember that.
Kingpin was, it was kind of weird. I had a kind of love-hate relationship with Kingpin.
Okay.
You know, he was this big guy. I always wondered, like, how can he possibly beat Spider-Man? I mean, Spider-Man can beat up the Hulk, you know, and Juggernaut and the Rhino. What about the Rhino? All Kingpin was a step down from the Rhino. Yeah. He was intriguing in a way that he was with the underworld, and that kind of brought the mafia, you know, and they called it the Magia rather than the mafia because they didn't want to upset the Italian
community. The Magia.
The Magia, is that what it was?
That's how I've always read it. I do want to mention, though, on this topic of supervillains, we did run a poll on our X account to ask everybody, just give them a smattering, like, who do you think is Spider-Man's greatest foe? And so Venom got 5.9%, Dr. Octopus got 17.2%, and then guilt, I just put guilt in there because he's always struggling, right? He's got the guilt. Green Goblin won overwhelmingly, 60.9% of the vote went to Norman Osborn as Green Goblin. However, I feel that Dr. Octopus is the villain. I feel like he should have been the arch nemesis to Spider-Man. He makes the most sense thematically as opposed to the Green Goblin in just visual concept, right? Like, he's an evil opposite version of Spider-Man, though. He's a scientist, but he's kind of one step beyond Peter's level. He's an old man. Peter's, you know, is a young teenager at the beginning of these things. You know, he's got extra arms, which makes him actually a little more spider-like in appearance. Yeah. He got his powers in a lab accident like Peter, but it was kind of caused by his own attitude and hubris, right? So it's just like, there's all these things where I feel like Otto Octavius is, he just fits more in the Spider-Man universe, because what does a guy in a goblin costume have to do with anything? Like, but it was the writing. Yeah, it was what they did to the character to make it work that is so impactful. But I always just like, but really, it's Doc Ock. Come on, man.
But, you know, I do agree with everything you say, but I don't agree with you on a guy in a green costume. You got to remember, this guy was mentally deranged. Okay. You know, it's just like these B horror movies, you know, where the clown is
or
the monster.
Or a guy in a hockey mask. What does that have to do with anything?
You know, yeah. Because he's deranged, right? And that's what the Green Goblin is, you know? And so many memorable stories, I mean, so many arcs came from the Green Goblin. Again, yes, Dr. Octopus, I agree with everything you say. The only downside with Dr. Octopus was it was kind of corny with the arms. And I always wondered, how did he ever hide all those arms beneath his clothes?
That's true.
I could never figure that out. You know, he'd go out with Aunt May, right? You know, he tried to swoon her. And he's got these arms underneath. I mean, didn't she ever hug him?
All right. So moving on, Adam and I grew up in an era where Peter Parker and Mary Jane were married while Gwen Stacy was dead and buried. But Dad, you were reading when Gwen and Peter were a hot item and he had dated Betty Brant. So who do you think is really the love of Peter's life?
Oh, Gwen Stacy. Gwen Stacy, of course. I mean, Betty Brant was a girlfriend. I mean, I don't think he was that serious about her. And I think they wrote that. I think Steve Ditko wanted to keep it light. Well, actually, Liz Allen was his first girlfriend, and then Betty Brant, you know, became his girlfriend afterwards. But I think Gwen Stacy was really in his heart and soul. But we have to remember, this is just a character. This is just a...
He's well, real.
But yeah. You know what? When you're a teenager reading these things, it was like, oh my God. Oh my God, he's so in love with her. I'm in love with her too.
Well, and I feel like that maybe there is kind of that divide, right? You know, because, you know, Mary Jane comes in and fans of a certain generation are saying, yeah, but it should have been Gwen, you know? And now you've read so much more than I have, but this has always been my take in you know, the stories featuring both that I've experienced, because it felt like Gwen was kind of, in a way, like an unattainable girl. I know Liz Allen was really that, but like this kind of like one step above Peter Parker, that he got lucky to date her and the death was tragic, but it feels like they would not have ever been married in the end. She seemed too idealized in the way she was written, that she was not like a real life partner for day to day. Whereas like, yeah, MJ has like supermodel good looks, but when written correctly, she's really tough. She's resourceful. She matches Peter's sense of humor. Like it felt like Gwen maybe wasn't going to relate to Peter the way that MJ seemed to get him. I mean, you know, we have the storyline later and she lived in the same neighborhood, you know, she had her own share of family hardships. Her life was not a cakewalk, just like Peter's was rough. And she knew he was Spider-Man all along and she pursued him and agreed to marry him, even though, you know, there was some back and forth there. So it didn't like Gwen was like afraid of Spider-Man. So it seems like that could have never worked. He would have had to have been lying to her all the time, which is good for drama. But I don't know, good for the relationship. But I was just like, when I put the pieces together, it's like the true passionate love is Gwen. But could they have made it work? I wonder, you know?
I remember when you read me the issues and they tease her a bit, Mary Jane. And then when that page reveal, I remember you doing the page reveal. And I was just like,
yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I fell in love with her. I was like, forget Gwen Stacy for
now. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was because she was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She was fun.
Face it, Tiger.
Exactly.
Because he tried to avoid her for so many issues. It was like 20 issues, you know, even from Steve Ditko's time. And finally, John Romita Sr. I agree with you. But I think Gwen was more of an anchor for him. And I think we have to remember that Amazing Spider-Man and Marvel Comics is a business. And you couldn't marry off Peter Parker. They had to eventually do something with Gwen. It had to end somehow. Even though I was so totally pissed off when issue 121 came out about, you know, Gwen being killed off. I was just so let down. You know, I thought there was a better way. I don't know. But, you know, when you think back, it is a business and they had to evolve and they had to bring in somebody like MJ to bring it back to Spider-Man being more light and him dating and him being a free person. And yeah, they evolved MJ through the years, eventually marries her. But you're looking at 5-10 years down the road. They got an extra, you know, they got an extra 5, 10, 15 good years out of Amazing Spider-Man, you know, where they kept him as basically a teenager yet, you know, or young adult Whereas if he would have married Gwen Stacy, he would have grown a beer belly and, you know, became a father and
Earth X Spider-Man.
Only did his web slinging, you know, between babysitting.
Neither of you are reading the modern comics, but Ultimate Spider-Man, they currently have rebooted it where he doesn't know that he was Spider-Man, doesn't know he has powers, and he has a family. It's a really interesting take on Spider-Man. You guys should both check out Ultimate Spider-Man. They're on issue 3 right now.
Oh, I got to. Yes.
They're on like the fourth printing. So like,
let me write that down.
Both of you. You too, Adam.
I'll buy some modern Spider-Man comics. I'll check it out.
Just Ultimate.
And pick up my copy of Armored and I'll get the back issues of Ultimate Spider-Man. Okay. Here's the thing, guys. Many people were first introduced to Spider-Man through TV. They have a piece. It's kind of a little sidebar, but let's take a look here just to kind of run through. Most people probably remember these, but yeah, so there was the classic Spider-Man series from 1967 to 1970 with the iconic theme song. But then probably my first live action Spider-Man was on the Electric Company, reruns of that 70s Sesame Street competitor where he didn't talk, but they had like word balloons that would come up crawl around. But then there was the Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man TV movies and TV series. What? Oh, okay, Joe, you were not a fan at the time, huh?
Hey, I watched every one of them, though. I was always willing to find something in there that I liked.
Oh, that's great.
It's only on for one season, though, right?
Yeah. Now, there was the Spider-Man Japanese television series, which, of course, we didn't get to experience here in North America, but it has kind of come over slowly, and that's a real fascinating piece with, like, giant robots that transform and everything. Like, wow. The Spider-Woman DePatie Frayling animated series, which was in the late 70s, which was very cool with the Jessica Drew Spider-Woman. And then, of course, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and the solo Spider-Man series that were kind of concurrent in 1981 through 1984, that era, until finally we had the 1994-95 Spider-Man series on the Fox Kids Network that Mike was talking about. So I'm sure you experienced all of these. So which do you feel translated Spider-Man best for the screen, Joe?
Well, obviously the 90 ones. Michael watched them, and I got to admit, I didn't have time to watch all of them. But what I did see, and I saw quite a few of the episodes, I really enjoyed it. The art was amazing. And for that period of time, that was the best interpretation for a series. But we're not talking movies, though, right?
Yeah, we're not talking movies right now. Yeah, we're just talking series. TV. Yeah. Yeah. Mike, do you agree?
The 90s series is the best. I have kind of a soft spot for Spidey and His Amazing Friends with Iceman and Firestar, but that's a more recent discovery for me. Like I bought the complete series from the UK, Amazon UK, a few years back, and I'd never seen them before, but there's something about them that I love. They're terrible, but I like the villains that show up.
Yeah, well, that series is so fun because, yeah, they really did pull in everybody from the Marvel Universe.
Everyone, yeah.
Like Captain America and Namor, huh? What's going on? Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I would agree. Now, I have a very special place in my heart for the 70s TV series. I loved watching those reruns. Like, they were so fascinating. I'm just like, this doesn't make sense as Spider-Man, but it's still Spider-Man, so I'll watch it. I recorded them. But I have to agree with you guys. It's hard to beat the 90s series because what it really captured was the soap opera aspect of the Spider-Man universe because they did those multi-part, full season-long arcs, right? And they're bringing in guest stars and everything, but it had a consistent story. They weren't just one-off episodes like most animation was.
It was like X-Men. It's the same team that did X-Men, so it was.
That was a great series too. Yeah.
The only thing is, I hated the animation even as a kid. I did not like the animation on the 90s series, but the storytelling was so great and the voice talent was so good that I still enjoyed it. But it was an education for a 90s kid to say, "Oh, maybe I'll go out and look up these old storylines and see how they compare and whatever." So, but yeah. The animation was too weird to me because it was just like, it was weird, like video stilted stuff. They would like freeze frames for like to add extra seconds. So I was just like, this looks so bad, like distorted, you know?
But you're comparing that to the 70s artwork? And
the 80s art was great.
Okay, the 80s,
very fluid sunbow animation. Like, I love that.
Yeah. Jim. it was so funny because in the 60s, I saw it advertised in all the comics that I got. I remember it was an ABC at the time, but the ABC affiliate in Buffalo didn't carry it. And that was the only ABC affiliate that we could get here in Canada, you know, being so close to the border. That's the only one we could get. And they didn't carry it. So I didn't really get to see those cartoons until the 70s.
Oh, bummer. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I know. It's amazing. I mean, I wasn't even into comics that much in the later 70s. I still watched them.
The next article we have is simply amazing, and it ranks the 10 best Spider-Man stories of all time. As you might have guessed, most of these are from the 80s, a time when the Wizard staffers were part of the comic book consumer public and not the media. So let's run through these guys. So I'll start. So the number 10 on the list is High Tide, and it's Spider-Man versus Wolverine issue. It's a pretty iconic cover, in my opinion. Yeah. I haven't read it, I have to say, so I'm not as familiar with it. How about you, Adam?
Oh, yeah. So I got this at a garage sale, probably like 1992. Somebody was selling off their son's comic book collection. I remember I got a ROM number one, ROM Space Knight, and I got the Spider-Man versus Wolverine issue. And I was reading it, and the funniest moment to me in this, because, you know, it's Wolverine, like, is on this mission. So is Spider-Man in Germany, and they're trying to, like, figure out what's going on because Wolverine's helping an old friend. But the funniest part is Peter Parker goes, he doesn't have his costume because it gets lost in customs or something. So he has to go to a costume store and he gets a Spider-Man Halloween costume that says Die Spider on the back of the spider. And it's just so funny to me. Like, that always stuck out. Next one here, If This Be My Destiny. So there you go, from Amazing Classic. Spider-Man 31 through 33. I mean, this is like the iconic imagery, right? You see this all the time with Spider-Man, you know, underneath all the machinery. And what is he trying to do? He's trying to save Aunt May, that he's covered in the machinery, and he's all his willpower. He's already like kind of beaten and tired and everything. And how's he going to do it? And so, Joe, what do you remember about this issue and reading this for the first time?
Oh my God. I read it and reread it and reread it. It was just, and still to this day, when I read it, it still gives me goosebumps. Such an iconic trilogy that really shows the essence of Peter Parker, not Spider-Man, but Peter Parker. The selflessness and the love, you know, and the determination is just beyond. It was good writing. Really good writing. I don't know if it was because I was just a kid when I read it and it's just nostalgic now, or if it really is good writing.
For something that is like mostly like, you know, a big chunk of it is monologue, just this guy, you know, with himself. It's just like visual drama. You know, it's theater.
The visuals too, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, him finally lifting it, just summoning every bit of strength he's got and willpower he's got to lift that machinery that was on top of him so he wouldn't die, you know. And the thing is, he was so close to death too. That's the crazy thing. Yeah.
Mike, what's number eight here?
Shadows of Evil's Past. I remember I had one of these issues. I never had both, I don't think. It's issues 238 to 239 of Amazing Spider-Man. It's all about the Hobgoblin, right? And like the mystery as to who he is and all that.
It went on for quite a while in the comics. Yeah. So how did you feel about that? Because I would feel like if you love the Green Goblin, you're like, they're just ripping off Green Goblin and bringing in a new version. But like,
that's what I felt. Yes. That's the way I felt about it. Yeah.
But I just like the look of Hobgoblin. So I was like, oh, he's cool. He's got red eyes.
Number seven is Venom, which is just, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 300. You know, so this is Todd McFarlane era. Venom is coming into the picture for the first time. They're facing off. I mean, that cover has just been seen over and over again. It's been homaged over and over again. People just love that moment in time. I mean, for us, like, Venom was like the guy. Like, he was so hyped during our era of getting into, you know, deep into collecting. It's just like,
oh, and Carnage. Well, I remember, Michael, you were so into, you thought Carnage was just the greatest villain ever.
I love serial killers.
Yes.
Number six was the death of Jean DeWolf, which is Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man, numbers 107 to 110. I, again, not familiar with this at all. I don't know if this rings a bell for you guys at all.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's mentioned a lot, but it's not one of those things that I've ever gone back to read, because they mention in the girlfriend section when they talk about Peter Parker's love interest that she was like an unrequited love sort of thing, where it's like they had attention, but they never really acted on it. And then she gets killed by the Sin Eater here. That was kind of a big deal, like this, because the Sin Eater storyline, from what I understand, is what leads into Eddie Brock becoming Venom, because he thinks he exposes who the Sin Eater was, but they find out he was wrong, and Spider-Man catches the real guy, and then he's bitter. So it all plays together that way. But yeah, but the I guess for people that were really deep reading this era, they're like, she's dead. No.
And I think Sin Eater played a role in one of the most recent Spider-Man comics, like a couple of years ago. That's what's really weird. He came back. So I guess he is popular enough that someone was inspired to bring him back.
Now, another one that they do that is a kind of a one-off story in the number five spot is from Amazing Spider-Man number 248, which is called The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. And so it's basically about Spider-Man visiting his biggest fan, this kid who collects any type of ephemera related to Spider-Man. He knows everything about him. And so they have this like long talk about like sacrifices he had to make and all these things that eventually reveals his identity to the kid. One of those stories that's just like, he really cares about the fans. You know, it's like in a play to every fanboy, right? It's just like, oh, I could be him.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. Yeah, that's funny. That kind of hits home for me.
Yeah. I'm shocked that the next one, number four, is number four, but it is Amazing Fantasy 15, Spider-Man. I feel like that should just be number one. It's classic.
Really?
Well, I mean, you know what? They're just looking at like the storytelling, I guess.
The concept was there, and I think the story was pretty weak. Because it was Steve Ditko's first Spider-Man story. It was, God, only, what, about 8 pages long? It was just part of the Amazing Fantasy 15. The story could have been told a lot in more detail, with a little bit more feeling, I think. But we got to remember, it was 1962.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a trial for Amazing Fantasy 15 to see if they could carry that comic book on. But it ended up being such a big hit because it was realistic. And there was nothing else like it out there. You would never find that in any of the DC comic books, where a superhero going out looking for vengeance to get this guy. So that was the concept that really made Marvel.
Now, number three is called Caught in the Act. This is the one where I'm like, why is this on the list? It's from Amazing Spider-Man number 231 and 232. It's something to do with a super slick super villain called the Cobra, who can go through ventilation ducts and sewer pipes. He's stealing things from the evidence lockers at a police station. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Hyde was like his old partner, and they're like having some type of disagreement. Like, this is Wizard's justification why it's great. This two-parter features the perfect spider personality. Yeah, he's getting his ass handed to him, but all the while, Wet the Webhead's spouting one-liners faster than Chevy Chase's career plummeted.
His career hasn't been better since he was in my movie, so...
That's right, Chevy Chase in Arlstein Zombie Town. But it's just funny to me, because I'm just like, I guess, because all they're showing here is Mr. Hyde, but then they're at the end, they're saying, no, it's because Spider-Man's funny in this issue, and he's never been funnier, I guess? I don't know.
Oh, weird.
That's a strange choice.
Yeah.
Number two is The Night Gwen Stacy Died. To me, that is just so... It's integral to the Spider-Man story.
I agree, yeah.
And I always just think about kind of how that was recreated in Marvels when Alex Ross did it.
Yes. Like, oh my God, so good in that.
That's where I connect with Gwen, is kind of that little behind-the-scenes look at her, you know, those last days. Number one is Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut, which they turned into an episode of the Spider-Man cartoon series in the 80s. They like basically just interpreted that, where he's just coming through town. He's just, you can't stop him. How are you going to figure it out?
I love this story because, again, it brought out the passion in Spider-Man as well to defeat this character. I mean, he was all over the place, and I like the artwork in that. I just, it was a fabulous story.
Oh, and I do want to mention about that story just because it's relevant as of, you know, right now. But they say that part of that story, it says, for their latest shtick, Black Tom Cassidy and the Juggernaut decide to kidnap the powerful psychic Madam Web. And then it says, with her psychic powers, Madam Web foresees a lumbering behemoth rising out of the water and whisking her away. She also visions a certain gladiator fighting for her life, yet failing miserably. A certain red and blue wall crawler. So after contacting Spider-Man, Madam Web sits and waits nervously.
So now that we've gone through the list, are there any that you guys feel are missing? Like, I think to me, as a 90s kid, I feel like Maximum Carnage is missing, but what do you guys think is missing, if any?
I mean, I could say, as much as Wizard hated it and it would never make the list, I think the first few months of the Clone Saga are actually really engaging and a great way of just like pulling out and expanding on a piece of the character's history that had just been cast aside at that point. Oh, here's a few issues with a clone, you know, back in the 70s or whatever. But the idea of Peter and Ben trying to determine who was the true Peter Parker, there's a lot of philosophical areas that were being explored, identity and reality, and they just weren't handled well for the sake of maintaining sales. Like, let's do it for like 2 years, it's too long. But I feel like at the beginning that was a really interesting, like, what can we do with this?
I remember taking that saga to a cottage. I may have been my aunt and uncle's cottage, and just reading it all. Like, I had saved it all for them.
Oh, wow.
I loved it. Yeah. Was there any that stick out to you, Dad?
The one series that sticks out for me in Amazing Spider-Man are the drug issues. What was that, number 98? I don't understand why that wasn't on the list, because there was such controversy about that.
Yeah.
And it was really a trendsetter. I mean, I think that's when the Comics Code Authority was... around that time, it was canceled. And it was really, you can give credit to Stan Lee for pushing that. And he just said, we're publishing it anyways, you know, to hell with the Comics Code Authority, because we have to make a statement on this. But really, Spider-Man made statements on everything. I mean, the Vietnam War, they showed protests going on, you know, anti-war protests. And I mean, there was even, I mean, women's liberation at the time, you know, I mean, I think there was even some states in the early 60s that didn't even let women vote yet, you know, as well as a lot of other Western countries in the world, you know. So there were so many things that happened in Amazing Spider-Man that are so iconic and so memorable. But the drug issue, I think they missed the boat when they didn't include that.
Yeah, get rid of that Mr. Hyde story and the Cobra. Put it in that one.
All right.
Now, as we're wrapping up here, you know, we love the Mort of the Month feature in Wizard, where they bring up the most ridiculous characters in comics. And Spider-Man was certainly not averse to having embarrassing moments. And so they rank the top 10 most embarrassing moments in Spider-Ham, which really feels like it should have been an in-depth analysis of the legacy of Peter Parker. But this is what we got. Now, we're not going to discuss everything on this list, because most of it is just like, remember that time he couldn't get into his apartment? Remember that time he almost fell on his webs? Remember that time that he had to go to the laundromat? Like, none of it was actually embarrassing or funny or strange, except for, Joe, you got to tell us about this. This is Amazing Spider-Man 141. I think I have a Marvel Tales reprint or something of this, because I've read this to my son as a bedtime story. But Human Torch built Spider-Man the Spider-Mobile at one point, and then to get rid of it, they literally just kind of run it off a pier, and then it's gone forever in an accident. What did you think of the Spider-Mobile, Joe?
That is undoubtedly the most embarrassing thing. I thought, oh my God, they're trying everything. They're throwing everything against the wall. I thought, God, please don't let this be another Batmobile. The Spider-Mobile is embarrassing. That is just so unbelievable. I mean, everything else in this list is at least a tad believable. Spider-Mobile just is not believable.
Yeah. Yeah.
My son has a Spidey and his Amazing Friends one.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, though. Can you think of, outside of the Spider-Mobile, or Mike, you know, from our era of reading, you know, in the 90s especially, is there a true just embarrassment in the publication history of Spider-Man where you're just like, this was a stunt, or this was just something, this is a moment, a panel I remember reading and saying, no, this doesn't belong here. Like, is something come to mind for you guys?
I don't tend to look at comics like that in a negative way, I guess. I don't know. Even like the spider car, I love it.
Yeah.
Especially if the series is going on. for hundreds of issues, I guess. I just am like, yeah, there's going to be some duds or whatever. But there's nothing that stands out to me. Adam. Okay. There's nothing that, yeah.
Yeah. Again, we have to remember this is a business.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand why they put the spider cut. They wanted to bring fun back into the comic, you know.
But I think there was a
comics were pretty dark.
But the spider car came in. I just read about this the other day. I don't know if it was in Wizard even. It could have been in Wizard. It was the toy manufacturers they made more money on vehicles. And so they were like, let's just make a spider car. And so they could make more money on a Spider-Man car than a Spider-Man action figure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember reading that as well. And that's what we have to remember. It is a business.
Yeah.
And whether we like it or not, you know, they're going to try to put not only fun back into it, but they're going to try to make money on it as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Marvel were trailblazers in pretty much everything from writing and concepts and things. But, you know, face it, you know, they needed something that they could market. And toys were starting to become the thing.
I remember in the early 90s when they were trying to make him grim and gritty for a time, Peter Parker... At one point for a few issues, he's disassociating from his civilian identity and he just starts calling himself the Spider. And he puts himself in a cocoon of webs in his bedroom and then he won't change out of his costume. I think this is like Spider-Man like 392, 393 or something like that. Amazing. And there's this image of him chomping on some fruit, crouched on a table, and it's just like dripping out of his mouth and he just looks like a maniac. And I always just thought, Spider-Man losing his mind, that is not a gimmick we're on board for. That is not a part of the character. That's
Adam,
not here for.
You've just sold me on a story I want to read. You've done.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Me too.
So as we wrap up, Dad, what is your relationship with Spider-Man these days? I told you about Ultimate Spider-Man, the latest series. Have you been just looking at back issues? Like, what are your feelings? Is it just all about the movies now for you?
Yeah, I would say it's more about the movies. But, you know, you guys have gotten me interested in some issues that I'd really like to check out, like the Ultimate Spider-Man and this... Spider-Man number 392, you know.
Well, that one'll be easy for you.
But something has to pique my interest. To me, Spider-Man has just gone in so many different directions, and it's been so muddied, and a lot of the stories feel like they've been told already, and they're just rehashed into different characters. But sometimes there's a gem that comes along, and I depend on you, Mike, and Adam, to... give me information on some really great ones to read.
Go out and get Ultimate Spider-Man. You won't regret it, Dad.
Yeah.
Heard it here.
Very interesting. Okay. Yes.
I will just tell you that as far as like, if I'm looking forward to any new Spider-Man coming out, I saw the notice that Carr Andrews has a Spider-Man Reign sequel in the works. And enjoy that Spider-Man Reign, like, you know, for many years ago at this point. It was basically Dark Knight Returns for Spider-Man is what it was. But it really hooked me. And so they said there's supposed to be a new one coming out. So I will be on the lookout for that as well. But otherwise, yeah, it's mostly the movies and Spider-Verse for my kids. They're loving it. So we have a Spider-Verse calendar in our kitchen right now. That's how we keep all the dates. But either way, I did want to mention very quickly before we end the episode, there is an unforgettable part of this issue titled Spidey Takes Manhattan. It's a pictorial comic where Wizard staffer Jim McLaughlin tours New York City with the official costume Spider-Man performer, and he's visiting all the sites of his many adventures, but none of it looks like the comics. And he's like, hey, what gives, guy? And all this kind of stuff. But the costumed performer, his name is Jerry Colpitz, and we actually interviewed him on the Wizard Files a few years back about being Spider-Man for, like, Marvel all through the 80s. Like, he was the one at Shea Stadium who was in the costume and married a model who was dressed in the Mary Jane wedding dress and all that. So he was involved in so many things. So if you haven't checked out that interview, it's something to go back and enjoy. It's kind of a fun companion to our conversation we've been having here. Just a little more spider lore in that way. But Joe, honestly, we can't thank you enough for sharing your history, for sharing your stories and opinions. It's been really fun and added some extra flair to this conversation.
It was a lot of fun. A lot of nostalgia. Thank you so much, Adam.
Oh, my pleasure. So yeah, so stay tuned. We will be back soon with issue 91 of Wizard. We'll get into our coverage there. But in the meantime, also keep an eye out for some more interviews we have coming up. We're going to be talking to Darren Sanchez on the Wizard Files, who was a production manager at Valiant. We mentioned Valiant earlier. Now he's over at Marvel, but he also had a stint at Wizard for many years. A lot of behind the scenes from the office, from upstairs, we're going to find out. We're also arranging to talk to the guys from Ghost Machine who worked at Wizard. So Brian Cunningham, Steve Blackwell, we're bringing them together as a panel to kind of look back, okay, 90s comics, and what are they doing now with Ghost Machine, this new group of creators. So that's going to be very fun. But just to stay tuned to what we're doing, find us on social media at Wizards Comics. You can go to wizardscomics.com to check over 270 podcasts that we have available for you there. Interviews, coverage of Wizard Magazine, specials like this, everything you need. But also on YouTube, Mike has a bunch of haul videos. He's been traveling. We're going to be back with some more of that as well. You can see the cool key issues he's been finding in the bins for great prices. A super bargain hunter that he is. But thank you so much for checking this out. And until next time, keep your books bagged and boarded.
This has been a presentation of Geekster Media.